This episode of the Modern Witch Podcast is brought to you by Horticulture, a premier online event celebrating green magic in all its forms. This year, we have live and downloadable workshops by international best-selling authors and plant magic aficionados like Aaron Murphy Hiscock, Juliet Diaz, Eva Dominguez Jr., Amy Blackthorne, Kobe Michael, Jesse Hathaway Diaz, and me, Devin Hunter. Attendees get access to a private year-long Discord server, a digital grimoire featuring over 10 hours of additional bonus content from our presenters, and VIP access to the Rare and Magical Plant Marketplace. Horticulture happens April 23rd and 24th, with part of the proceeds benefiting the Nature Conservancy. Whether you're into herbs and the poison path, sacred gardening and ecology, rewilding your indoor space, or just want to meet other green magicians to share tips and cuttings, Horticulture is for you. Find out more at horticulture.com. That's HORTOCCULTURE.com or modernwitch.com. And act now. Early bird tickets are available only until March 20th. Horticulture, a celebration of green magic in all its forms, April 23rd and 24th, presented by Modern Witch.
What is that?
It's a little bag made from the skin of a toad.
Does it matter? She's tampering in dark sided stuff!
Yet in our own supremely rational time, there has been a dramatic rebirth of the ancient arts of witchcraft.
You're listening to the Modern Witch Podcast with Devin Hunter.
What's up?
That was for you, my fellow millennials and Gen Xers. You know what that's about. I'm digging things up and bringing them back out from, you know, the days of old, because that's where I'm at. I'm listening to all 90s music right now. I have started to work on some side projects that are very retro-y. And so, yeah, my 90s kid energy is very strong right now, and I am bringing it to this episode. Well, at least for the intro right there with the what's up, because you remember what that was, right? And then... Oh, there's so many annoying things from when we were younger, folks. If you are in your 30s like me, there was a lot of annoying crap when we were kids. The Who Let the Dogs Out song that was played everywhere and on every commercial at any opportunity. Remember that? Yeah. The Macarena. Okay. Yeah. The Macarena. Just think about that. The exact opposite of the Macarena is Jason Minke. And so Jason Minke is on the show today. He is here to talk about the process of writing witchcraft books, but with other people. And that was like a really fascinating thing to me. So I definitely dug into that. But he has released him and Matt Cavalli, Amanda Lynn, and Ari Minke, who is Jason's lovely wife. They all got together and they wrote this book called The Witch's Book of Spellcraft. And it's fantastic. It covers a lot of ground. There's a lot of good like gnosis and wisdom that's infused with just good how-to practical stuff that should be very foundational for a lot of us. And so it accentuates a lot of the things that you probably already think you know about spellcraft, or maybe you've just gotten kind of comfortable with. It's a good book. Definitely should be on every witch's shelf. So we're going to talk a little bit about a little bit of everything today, actually. And I'm really excited to bring this interview to you, because I always have a great, fantastic time talking to Jason. He's become a very good friend out here on the West Coast. And I love that he's doing this stuff. This is like book million for him. So definitely check it out. The Witch's Book of Spellcraft. I will have links in the show notes. And definitely check out Matt Cavalli and Amanda Lynn. I'm sure everybody, if you know Jason, you know Ari for sure. But Matt and Amanda might be new names for you. So definitely go check them out. Really fantastic practitioners. And I think that this is a good contribution to the current discussion that we have here as the people who are the stewards of witchcraft right now, because we're going to die and somebody else is going to pick it up, right? And so we're just having a discussion as a community, and Jason is always part of that. And I think that's fantastic. Anyway, you're listening to The Modern Witch. I am Devin Hunter, and we'll be right back with Jason Minke after this break.
This is the story of
of the Greek god Pan, one half goat, the other half man. He had a curly beard and horns on his head. He really was a panic, the Greeks all said. Pan, Pan, Greek god Pan, one half goat, the other half man.
You know the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, break on through to the other side, yeah.
Pan, Greek god Pan, one half goat, the other half man.
This experience where you realize maybe I didn't want to share that with people. You know, I originally wanted to share this with everybody, but then I was like, maybe that's just a special thing, you know, like maybe I don't need to do that now. Cause you're writing so much, you have like, I mean, you're like rapid fire putting, but cause you're taking it serious. I love that you take your job as an author seriously. I really love that because you have a writing practice. You have, you know, you've developed a skill set that allows you to, at the very least, when you need to, pump that out, right? That is to me, right. That is a spiritual quality. And I mean this not just because I'm a writer myself, but I recognize that as a writer or an artist, a painter and anything, when you sit down and you really have that, your craft sorted out enough for yourself that you can slip into it and you can kind of get even almost a little trancy. It's a little easy, but yet you're still there having to craft and sculpt something because it's not easy, right? But you know your skill so well that you're able to go at it. That's a special thing. That's like mastery, you know, and I recognize that there are people who got this down and people who do not. And because the people who don't have this down freak the fuck out like me. Like, I mean, I can write now. I've figured it out, but it took a long time because I would psych myself out of it. And you have this, I just wanted to, I admire this about you. You can do that thing that so many of us struggle to do. And I'm not trying to just be like, oh, Jason Miggy, but legitimately you have this thing down where you're able to slip into that. And I question, just because now we're talking about it, I know so many people out there are writing right now. And so many people aspire to be writers. You're doing this in a way that I want to do it. I look up to you and say, this guy has a writing practice that I want down. I see you do it. How on earth do you keep yourself sane? How do you keep yourself from getting talked out of this by the itty bitty shitty committee in the back of your head?
I will say that having contracts signed and deadlines helps a lot, right? Like if I didn't have that, like if I didn't have this pressing legal obligation on top of me, I probably wouldn't really get it done.
Well, I feel that. Yeah.
Yeah. But I like to write about the things that I love and I'm passionate about. And I hope that comes out in the writing. But when I'm writing about those things, it gets much, much easier. The only time it's like really a slog is if I'm writing about something that I don't care about. And in every book, there's probably a little bit because you have to get from point A to point D, but maybe you don't really want to write about points B and C other than in passing. And that's the hard part, is getting through there. But I always kind of give myself a goal. You're going to do this many words, especially when the time crunch starts to come in, right? Like I'll admit I've been like completely goofing off since December 12th, when I got the last bit of corrections in for the next book. I was like, I'm going to take the holidays off. And now I'm like, I don't want to start anything again. This has been good. But yeah, write about what you love. Give yourself a minimum that you have to do. The more you write, the easier it gets, right? So even when I don't feel like writing and I know I need to write, I will still sit down and do it. And I often think, wow, this is going to be shitty. This is going to be terrible. While I'm writing it, I often think, this is crap. And then I go back and I read it 2 weeks later. And I'm like, this is pretty good. I guess I can do this.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's a secret, though. It's just doing it.
Do you feel like there's some sort of like spiritual thing that happens with that? Like, do you feel that your writing is somehow connected to your spirituality more than just the fact that you write about it? Like, is it a part of it? Like, do you consider writing to be part of your practice? And again, like, are there spirits that you're talked to, or do you feel like you're aligned with gods? Like, how does this fit into your life?
I think the gods push the pen. I do, or push the keyboard, or make me type on it, or whatever that works, how that works out. But yes, I do think that there's kind of a force that propels you forward to do a lot of these things. Certainly when I wrote the Horned God book, I could feel him nearby. I could see him like smiling at me like, way to go. I'm so glad you're doing this for me. Right. And that was there, and it was an act of devotion. I don't think it's witchcraft though. That's one thing that it's not. It's an act of devotion, but it's not a part of my magical practice, so to speak. Like, I want to do witchcraft after writing books. It makes me want to do ritual and light candles and burn incense and stuff. But it is an act of devotion. The Greek Gods book, which comes out in December, that I co-wrote with Astrea Taylor, you know, that was kind of tough because, you know, we have to split up all the Greek gods and you don't have relationships with all of them. But while I was writing the book, though, I could feel the relationships develop. I could feel like Hera going, you know, I've been really mistreated. Can you get this fixed for me? I promise I'm not the shrew that mythology sometimes makes me out to be.
Okay, legitimately, I have had this exact same conversation with Hera.
Yeah.
Like literally, because... okay, let's just unpack this, because this is actually a fun conversation and I think people need to hear it. This, I feel like she has been vilified, and it's all Kevin Sorbo's fault.
I don't think it's Kevin Sorbo. I mean, I think the mythology is bad, right? And I don't think the mythology presents Hera as she was worshipped in the ancient world, was a goddess that was beloved of the people, who was important, who fulfilled important things in their lives. You know, when we think of Hera, we often think of, oh, that's the goddess who torments all of Zeus's lovers and their children, like Hercules. And like Hercules is like, means what, beloved of Hera, something like that. I mean, he's works for her, right? I mean, that was how the myth originally was, and somehow it's completely corrupted now.
No, see, I did not know that. That's interesting. Yeah,
like she is all of a sudden the antagonist, and that doesn't really make sense when you actually go and look at, you know, what Hercules's name means and how Hera was honored. And even in Rome, you know, when she was adopted by the Romans, they still liked her quite a bit too. But all the mythology is always just so mean-spirited.
Oh my gosh, that makes so much sense. I've never even thought about his name, because they're always presented as being, you know, kind of a juxtaposition to each other. So that's, I'm totally tripping out on that. That's fascinating. So what is it that, this is something that I've also thought about, because you have written a lot about gods and our relationship to them. And I love that you have, well, okay, so two things. I appreciate that you're an actual pagan who is on a modern pagan on pursuit of understanding the ancient spirits, these gods, in the way that you do. And I do appreciate that. But then the flip side of it is, I love that as a witch, you have a connection to these gods in the way that you do. And it comes out in the way you write about them, whether it's the Horned God or you're writing about a goddess that you've been working with. It's all there. So I really do I appreciate your opinion on these things. Okay. I think this is, I'm trying to butter you up for something here, but I appreciate your opinion on these things. As a modern pagan, as a modern witch, we have an advantage now as we're looking back on ancient cultures, as we're looking back on even just periods in witchcraft history. All right. When like practices and things that went down that we could look back and go, oh, there's no fucking way that would be okay today. If this tradition was sculpted into the year 2022, there is no way on earth that it would survive, because the politics have changed, or the state of affairs have changed, right? The culture has changed. So we have the, you know, hindsight's 2020. You know, we can look back and we can be very judgmental, and we can take things in, you know, with our modern realization, our modern awareness,
and apply it onto the past when it comes to some of this stuff, like, you know, these gods. Like, we just unveiled this interesting story about Hera, right, and Hercules. Now, these are things that we didn't know. I mean, at least this was definitely not something that would have been talked about, I don't know, 12 years ago, 10 years ago. And so we have this advantage now. What do you think, as somebody who has this relationship to these gods and have studied them in the way that you have, what do you think are the biggest advantages? Because I feel like we almost have some unspoken metaphysical privileges here, being able to look back and understand things. You know, you're told the big story of the, like, let's say the Greek gods, right? We're all told this in middle school, elementary school, right? It's on TV, it's in cartoons, it's in everything. And so then you look back on it now, you have a much different, better understanding of what was really going on, right? What are some of those biggest understandings? What are some of those bigger things that you now kind of can walk into this research, this study with, that are helping you not just study, you know, further this connection to them, but just as like a witch, as a scholar, as somebody who's interested in uncovering that spiritual connection? Like, what are those tools that you're walking into these things with? Because I'm very interested in, and I've always wanted to pick your brain about, but we've never really gotten it. We haven't had time to just sit down and do this kind of thing. So I want to pick your brain about this. Like, what are those tools that you're walking into this research, this field of study with?
Well, the biggest thing now, which is really different than just 20 or 30 years ago, is our access to knowledge and information. It's almost unprecedented. You can get any book that you want, you know, within to your house within like 3 days, right? And then there's all the internet stuff. I guess for me, when I study ancient deities, and, you know, whether it's the Horned God or the Greek gods, and when that book comes out in a couple of months, it's getting to dive into what people felt 2,000 years ago and see how those relationships existed in the ancient world. Because I think when we think about the gods, sometimes we see them as being sort of preserved in the amber of mythology, right? We don't see them as figures that people actively gave offerings to and prayed to. Like, so, you know, researching Zeus, I had to write the history of Zeus in our book. And Zeus, you know, we know the stories of Zeus. They're usually about impregnating women to be, you know, completely like, I don't know how to say it without, you know, trigger warning. You know, Zeus is often uninvited when he comes into a woman's bed, right? I mean, he doesn't seem like a sympathetic figure. Powerful, yes, but not somebody that you wanted to hang out with. And then you read about the gods and you read about how people viewed them 2,500 years ago, or some of what the epitaphs of Zeus were. And all of a sudden, Zeus is like the friend and he's a helper to people. And you just don't expect to read about Zeus and the people who left him offerings, kind of like walking hand in hand through Athens together. But metaphorically, it seems like that was the case. And at least, you know, amongst some worshipers and things. So I love that. I love getting to know what those relationships between deities and people were like 2,500 years, instead of just reading about, oh, Hera hated Hercules or whatever it was. And when I read about how people had those relationships 2,500 years ago, I think it opens up new ways of understanding for me when it comes to the gods, instead of just seeing them as they were presented in Edith Hamilton's mythology or Bullfinch's mythology. Now there's this being there with these extra layers. And now it's like, oh, now I know why people like tried to build the biggest temple in the history of the world to Zeus in Athens at one point, that kind of thing. Because for a long time, we didn't really have access to that stuff. Everything was sitting in an old academic journal, right? That we couldn't get a hold of.
Right.
And,
right.
And now it's easier than ever before to get a hold of that stuff. And that, yeah. I love that so much. And so that's really influenced a lot of my practice and doing, I think, is knowing how the gods were worshipped then. Though I'll also say that, you know, I'm moving more and more away from the word pagan. I don't think it's bad or whatever, but, you know, because I find the past fascinating, that doesn't mean I want to do things like they did in the past. I don't think that the gods are beings preserved in amber. I do think that they change and grow. I do think that their mythology is constantly being added to. You see that especially with Greek gods. I mean, there's, you know, kind of a movement to gate the Greek gods sometimes. Well, you're not Greek. You can't worship the Greek gods. Well, the Greek gods were worshipped from India to Great Britain. I mean, they were worldwide.
Well, and not even that.
Right.
I think we just take. So my big thing is I love actual history. Like I love to like ancient history, especially stuff that was like right now. My big kick is the fall of Rome and that transition of like what really happened, because that has such a huge impact on our understanding of what paganism is and, you know, what it was. But even before that, we cannot, like, let's just say when the fall of Rome happened, like we lost everything. Like we lost so much information. We lost so much technology. We lost a lot. We were set back as like a Western culture. We were massively set back, and then plague and all these horrible things happened. And so much of what our civilization had to rebuild off of and had relics of the past were like the Greek statues and were Roman statues that were left in places, especially, and this is really evident in the island of Britain, right? But so much of what we have for just reconstructing Western culture has to do with these people looking at the runes, right? Or the ruins of ancient civilizations, which just happened to be Greek and Roman, right? And building our Western understanding off of that and just of who we are as a people and where our great civil, you know, where our great history is as a Western people. We always look to places like Greece. We look to Rome. We look at their gods. We look, you know, of course, even, you know, Germanic tribes, and that's a whole thing unto itself. But what I'm saying is we always look into the past, and it just happens to be that in the West, the two cultures that we tend to build ourselves off of are the Greeks and the Romans. And we, just as a civilization, you know, and I know, realize that a lot of pagans get into the British stuff, which is super great, but just not a lot of people know who the Morgu is, right? Or not a lot of people know who Maka is, right? But everybody knows who Zeus is. I'll also say, if I may, that hello, the Olympics.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I feel like the Greek gods belong to Western civilization. I feel like they created Western civilization. The Roman gods created Western civilization pretty much as we know it in a lot of ways. And to say that we don't have the right to worship them because we're not ethnically Greek is so arrogant and ignorant and dismissive of the actual importance that these particular pantheons actually, you know, had on ours, just as a culture and as a civilization. So that always grinds my gears big time. Like, I understand if you're like, hey, you don't have the right to invoke this Mexican spiritual, you know, thing that came from the rainforest because you're not. I get that. I respect the fuck out of that. I, you know, or the Aboriginal dream god. You don't get to. I understand that. I'm chill with that. But we're talking about the Greeks and the Romans, who literally were the spark that set off the Western world. And so this just always baffles me, Jason. Baffles the fuck out of me.
Well, and also, I mean, they adopted Christianity. This is not an unbroken chain, right? Where the Greek gods were being worshipped just like they had been in Athens up until the present day. It's very different than a tradition like voodoo or something like that, or Santeria, Absolutely. You know, which has been passed down, and you had to be initiated for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Right.
You know, that in the ancient world, you could walk into a temple, you know, maybe it was a Greek god, you know, and then maybe go see Isis in a temple that was nearby, also in Greece in the same city.
Absolutely.
Or you could be in Egypt and go and leave an offering to Athena or whatever. You could do the same in what is now Turkey or in Gaul. And sometimes the gods of those people would be sharing space with the Roman or Greek gods. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and they never left, too. I mean, they always are kind of sticking around, right? Even during the Middle Ages, with the height of everything has to at least pay lip service to Christianity. The days of the week in Romance languages, anything from Latin, still named after the gods of the Romans, right?
Right.
Also, the planets named after the gods. You know, you can't escape the gods. They're always there. And, you know, when the Renaissance came around, what was one of the big things about the Renaissance? It was about celebrating those deities after they really hadn't been celebrated for 800 or 900 years.
Absolutely. And then there's also that great, like, people also don't understand that the reason why those two cultures, the Greeks and the Romans, are so connected has a lot to do with the fact that the Romans went and conquered the Greeks and then took a lot of the scientists and the mathematicians and the spiritual people and anybody who really had a skill set, like doctors, and took them all as, you know, slaves. And those people ended up building the temples and constructing the temples and coming up with the ideas for things. And so Greek culture has had this huge spillover into what ended up becoming Roman culture. And the Romans had an even more liberal idea about spirituality, as you were saying, right? Like, there are, you know, hell, in Rome, there, how many, I don't even know how many temples there were. And we do know, as you know, there was one for Isis. And then there was right next to another one that was set up for Athena, right next to another one that was set up for Jupiter of blah, blah, blah. And this is just, it was much more fluid. And I think when we have this idea of being a polytheist, the glory to me of being a polytheist is that I can choose where I'm going to go put my money, right? And if that person or that God is not giving me what I need, I can go take my money elsewhere, right? I can go befriend somebody who will give me what I need. And I don't need to feel bad about it. Right. Like, I don't need to, this is how the game works. I know it. The spirits know it. Like, this is, you know, this is how it is. And there seemed to be this understanding of that in the ancient world, but that has not transferred over to modern polytheism. At least when we were discussing it, I think and for me, this comes from a lot of people who are consider themselves to be like solitary priests or priestesses of a god or goddess that they have a resonance with. And taking on that mantle of priest or priestess and what that means, I think it puts this over amplification, thank you, on the need to be like solitary still, or be like still have one deity that you're working with. Like, it still feels like monotheism as the default to me. Like, this is it, but with this, just with a Greek god or a Roman god or whatever god. You know, there isn't that fluidity there. And I question just like the power that we're giving over with that and just people not understanding that. Does that make sense?
It does. I mean, I think the ancient world was more like pagan soup, right? There's all these different ingredients in the stew. And maybe one day you're worshiping Pan and then the next day you're worshiping Mithra or whatever it is, because it's a soup, and you don't just have to only have one of the ingredients in the soup. And the gods, even, like, we have this idea that, you know, Zeus is Zeus or whatever. There's really like hundreds of sort of different Zeuses depending on where you are. You know, even in a city, there might be temples to different aspects of Zeus. And then when you go to another city, some of Zeus's mythology and the way that he's worshipped is different. So, you know, there's not just all of these gods, but even with one deity, there's all these kind of other versions of the deity at the same time. And it does kind of frighten me a little bit when I see people in the magical community almost start to embrace like a monotheistic mindset. You know, this is the goddess of witches, right? Like, this is the only one. I'm like, no. Like, any goddess that you worship is a goddess of witches, you know, like, there is no one god of witches, you know, there's no one deity of witches. And monotheism, you know, we talk about the fall of Rome, monotheism is responsible for a lot of problems.
It is.
I don't want us to pick it up. That doesn't mean people shouldn't feel devoted to a particular deity or whatever.
Right, of course.
But, you know, sometimes the fervor feels evangelical to me.
Yes. I think that's what I would, thank you. That's a good way of putting it. Cause that's how it feels to me too. And I, you know, and that's fine. Like I am devoted to Diana, who in a very, which is, you know, goddess of witchcraft kind of sense. But the first thing that we're taught is that there are thousands of goddesses of witchcraft, and we respect and honor each of them as that, as a goddess of witchcraft. And so whatever name that goes by, it's all serving the same power, right? So enjoy it, be a witch, you know, and there, we don't have that need. In the way that I practice that faith and my own personal faith, we don't have, in my students and my traditions and things, that there's no need to do that. You know, you can just chill out and have that relationship with whatever is speaking to you in the moment without feeling guilty. And do, you know, I mean, and it gets complicated. I totally get people not, like, if somebody doesn't want their, you know, this particular practice that came from this tradition to be, you know, done by people outside, I get that. Like, let's respect that. I think that's an important thing. But when it gets down to matters of whipping out, you know, that aspect purity card with the gods, especially like, you know, the Greek gods or the Roman gods, like it's not appropriate. It doesn't fit. Not, there isn't just one anchor point for anything. And I think that we get so stuck on trying to find those anchors of where this is what everything hinges on. And as a practitioner, I need to understand this particular hinge. And if I don't get to this thing, or if I falter from this thing, then I'm not going to be successful, or I'm not going to be rewarded. Because so much of people's relationships with these spirits, especially, you know, these gods, are about being rewarded. Oh, I'm going to be devoted and do these things. And even though we're all saying we were doing it humbly, there's still this idea that my God is going to favor me if I do these things, right? That's always been there. And so as a practitioner, as I'm mining that stuff and I'm trying to figure out what is valuable and what is maybe worth leaving off to the side, I question, and I'm going to hand this over to you with this, but I question, like, what are the aspects of this conversation that are actually worth it, like worth keeping with you, worth, you know, holding on to as you're developing your practice? And what are things that maybe it's not worth getting so hung up on or worrying about so much, especially in the beginning? Because it is a fact that 90% of the people who are buying tarot decks and books on witchcraft and things like that are actually new practitioners. And so right. And people who are listening to podcasts like this are newer practitioners. So this is the thing that comes up a lot in conversation and in emails and things like that. So what are the tools that are actually worth it here? Like, what are the things that are legitimate that we should think about, we should be concerned about? And what are things that people are getting hung up on that honestly, legitimately, in the grand scheme of things, maybe not so worth it?
Why did Searing scream and run? All I wanted was to have some fun. Well, Pan, my boy, as my father would say, tomorrow is another day. Pan, Greek god Pan, one half goat, the other half man.
The world is full of magic, and here at Datura Trading Company, we take that sort of thing seriously. Let's check on Jimmy as he enters his seventh hour of assembling his new IKEA cabinet.
Go in your hole.
What's wrong, Jimmy? You seem stressed.
I have been trying to get this assembled all day, and I have a big meeting in the morning, and I'm pretty sure my boss has been bitten by a werewolf.
Wait, what? Your boss is turning into a monster?
Yeah, he scheduled it for 7 a.m.
That's horrible, Jimmy. It sounds like you should have gone to DaturaTrading.com before this got out of hand.
Isn't that the place that used to be the Mystic Dream? Why would I go there?
Because they sell the best ethically sourced crystals and minerals that can help with anything from stress management to werewolf evasion.
Nah, crystals aren't really my thing.
They also have specialty made candles, oils, incense, and bath and body products made with the finest of ingredients from all over the world by occultists who know their shit.
You son of a bitch, I'm in.
And don't forget about the rare and magical plants. They even participate in the Save Our Species program to help conserve endangered plant species from going extinct in the wild.
Well, that's really nice, but why would I want a rare or magical plant?
Why? To go inside that new cabinet you just finished, of course.
Aha! Got it. Take that, you Scandinavian designer who doesn't like right angles. Wait, how did you know I was finished?
Because I'm the narrator, Jimmy. I see everything. I see
everything.
Don't forget to check the latest details at DaturaTrading.com. Sterling silver is on sale all holiday season. Werewolves hate silver, Jimmy. And remember, don't look at him in the eyes. That's how they steal the souls of your grandchildren. Bye-bye, Jimmy. Until next time.
Can you help me lift this up?
DaturaTrading.com, the home of esoteric essentials and beautiful design. Proud sponsor of Modern Witch.
I saw something like this, like a conversation about it online not too long ago. I guess that there's this idea that I'm doing it wrong. That's the one that I've never gotten. You can't do it wrong. All you can do is do it right. I mean, there's no right or wrong.
Absolutely.
When you practice magic, you're just practicing magic. You know, your goal is to raise energy and send it out into the universe to get what you want. And sometimes it works like we think it's going to, and sometimes it doesn't work exactly like we think it's going to, but it doesn't mean that we're doing it wrong. You know, like, oh, I didn't have this particular crystal and this particular herb, I'm doomed. No, it's not how magic works. Those things help you. They can be a useful step, but they're not even necessarily absolutes that you have to have when you do things. So I've always been somebody who likes doing. I've never liked like teaching witchcraft or anything. I just like doing witchcraft. And if people pick up on what I'm doing, then maybe I'm teaching. This is like kind of how our coven works. You know, we don't ever like go, okay, now this is what everybody needs to do. You know, my wife and I would just do the shit. And when we're working with people in our coven, we watch them get better at doing the shit because we're doing it together. And you can see like how we've learned to do it and not pick up on the mistakes that we've made over the years, which of course there have been many, but you know, and we just try to minimize those. But yeah, the idea that you can do it right or wrong. And also when it comes to deity, we've been talking a lot about deity, and I guess I'm like one of those witchcraft writers who writes a lot about deity, that people sometimes are like waiting for like a grand sign from deity, you know, like I'm supposed to be this, or I'm waiting for this and things. And it doesn't really work like that. There are times when you feel nudged to a particular deity. You know, I felt nudged to worship Pan and Dionysus when I was very much not like Pan or Dionysus in my younger years. You know, but it, the nudge, and then you just, you know, you kind of start the work. You leave them offerings, you talk to them. I mean, I think people want these grand gestures when they're trying to engage with relationships with higher powers. And that's not what it is. It's the little gestures. You know, like how do you develop a friendship? You talk to that.
You go person. Out and hang out.
Yeah. And totally. And I think deity is the same way.
Absolutely.
You build it small. Build a shrine. Build a place where they want to be.
Yeah.
Build a place where you can leave them offerings and devotions and things. And, you know, and then if you don't feel like it's being reciprocated, you don't have to do it. You don't have to continue to do it. You don't Absolutely. Have to continue to leave things. Sometimes, you know, you move on. I mean, I've had deities in my life that were really important for a couple of years. And then it feels like, you know, whatever they wanted from me, they got, and vice versa. And we went our separate ways. And, you know, that happens with friendships too.
Absolutely.
It's not the end of the world.
That's a really important distinction to make right now. And with everyone who's listening, because we're talking about building a friendship, you're building a partnership with this being, right? And sometimes they come and go, partnerships come and go, they serve a purpose, they need to do with their thing. And it's okay to walk away and go find new partnerships when that partner isn't able to do what it needs to do, right? It's come and serve its purpose. It's time for things to go. But it doesn't mean that you can't partner up with them again later. It doesn't mean that they don't, like, for me, you know, Pan is a very interesting god for me, and for many reasons, one of which is that, so did I ever tell you that I had like these crazy, I mean, and when I say crazy, I mean, I'm talking in a very like fun metaphorical way that could very means I could also mean very seriously because of some of the things that discussions that they were having with me as like a 13-year-old person on the internet. But I was told by this group of witches, who this coven in Cleveland, that I was part deity, that I was like, that me and they were, of course, it wasn't just me, it was the group of us. And they had met me on a Yahoo chat room. That I was the son of Diana. That's where all the fun shit happened.
Yes.
Oh, wow. Yahoo chat rooms. So this is back in the day. But they told me that we were like, that the goddess Diana and the goddess Pan at the beginning of time got together and had seven children. And put them into human bodies, but then realized that they were too powerful. So then they divided the souls, six of the souls up. And there were 13 souls who were they were called the Amara Sutra. And I was one of the Amara Sutra. Now, here's the thing, 13 years old. Who the fuck at 13 years old does not want to be told that they are half God? You know what I mean?
Right.
And so I was into it. I met one of them in a bookstore in Columbus. My father took me up on one of my weekend visits with him, and I was able to act because they were like, well, we don't really want to, you know, we don't give too much. We don't want to get in trouble with anything. So we have to get parental, you know, permission. And my dad, just trying to be the cool dad, was like, okay, yeah, you guys can chat. Just, you know, send your emails through this email so I can check them. He never checked my email. He had my password. He never fucking checked my email. So I had these like really, and of course it was all on Yahoo, right? So once they knew that my dad was okay with them talking to me, this is when all the weird shit started to come out, right? And you know, my dad just thought we were talking about casting circles or whatever. But you know, 13 years old, again, being told I'm a god, this is pretty amazing shit. Now, I eventually ended my conversation with them. I ended my time with those people because it was obviously going into a bad place, and I at least had some sort of wherewithal to get out of it. But Pan and Diana both are the gods that have stuck with me. And this is the weird thing. And I don't think I'm half God. I mean, no more than anybody else is, right? But that idea that like at a young age being told this really just crazy ass story, and how here I am in my mid 30s and I still worship these guys. I still work with these gods. They are still my go-tos. You know what I mean? Like we all have our own deities and that we work with, but these are the two deities that I just keep coming back to over and over and over again to the end. Then I go and study traditions, and then I get in like knee deep in the tradition, and I find out, oh yeah, okay, we're worshiping Diana and Pan. Right. And so there's just this, it's one of those things for me that with those deities, and I asked you this because of your own tradition, but part your own background, I feel like they were always with me, and I feel like they use whatever method they need to in order to get my attention. Right. And that's my personal story, right, with that. Do you feel like that? I mean, did you feel like you had these spirits, these gods with you, a part of your life before you started your training in Wicca? Do they show up after the fact, or like what is that like with you?
So in the ninth grade, I was in high school art class, and I have no artistic ability. I can be kind of creative, but I can't create things that look like other things. I'm totally there with you.
What art is like. Empathize, yes.
Yeah. So I'm in ninth grade art class and we're doing like a clay project, right? And so what do you want to make, Jason? Well, I think that I want to make a temple to Aphrodite out of clay. That was my ninth grade clay art project, right? And, you know, I thought that if I was ever going to fall in love, you know, and as, you know, a ninth grader, have some serious sex, right? I probably needed the help of Aphrodite. Now, this time, I am a conservative Christian kid, short hair, you know, didn't drink, smoke, anything like that. I was a really good kid, other than often failing in math. But I was a really good kid. And yeah, that was...
So was this done like innocently, or was this done like... Because I know you as such a jokester. So I just like, was this done to be funny, or was this done like innocently?
I think this was done magically. I think I really believe that if I left her things, I mean, because I had always had this fascination with the Greek gods from like the second grade on, you know, and I always asked my dad, why don't people worship those deities anymore? You know, and I never like took the step where I was in eighth grade and started, you know, praying to Apollo every time I looked at the sun. But I really felt like if I was going to get a girlfriend and fall in love, that maybe making a temple to Aphrodite and leaving offerings in it, because I had a little altar that was there. And in art class, I'd like make little penises and stick them on the altar in my project. And then when somebody would look, I would take it out and smush it, right? So no one could see that it was a penis. You know, so I feel like I was called to her a long time ago, and she's, you know, one of the house deities, and it's a primary deity my wife works with. And she's been very important to us since we've been together, and features and various rituals and Jim Morrison cults and things that we've perpetrated over the years. So yes, I do think that sometimes you look back and you can see that the calling and the nudging, right? And sometimes it takes odd forms like cults in Ohio. Right. And sometimes it takes the form of art projects and stuff, but I think that it's there. You know, I was not somebody who was really interested in Dionysus for a long time. And my wife and Pan don't get along. So Pan is important in the house, but they look at each other warily because Pan blames, well, Ari blames Pan for some things. Pan blames Ari for some things. It's complicated. But I, you know, like with Dionysus, I you know, I remember reading about Dionysus. I remember certain things. I remember college mythology class, like he was this huge unit in the mythology class, right? And I'd never spent time with him, and by that time I was practicing witchcraft and all that. So I remember I like had to send a worried prayer because I was behind on studying before a test. You know, it's like, I know this is about you. I'm sorry that we're not close. Can you help me through this? And then we started working with Dionysus. Like, we used to do this Jim Morrison ritual. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but we did this.
Oh, yeah. Like, it's quite famous. Yes, yes.
Yeah. It's, you know, honoring Jim Morrison as the 20th century incarnation of Dionysus, right? And walking the path of excess, but also being wary of not walking the path too much, because then you fall off the path and that's the end, right? Dionysus's myth is full of, you know, enjoy this stuff, but be wary of the consequences. So, you know, I found him through hard rock and music and the Doors and things, but it was this constant push. You know, you're going to build a place for me in your home. You and Ari are going to pour libations to me on a regular basis, you know, and I'm going to be a part of the things that you do. So absolutely, there's that push with deity. And, you know, and then there are sometimes people who want to be a part of like a deity, you know, they want to be close to a deity, and maybe they're not pushed like that, but they end up with a great relationship because they take the time to get to know the deity. And then maybe the deity's like, oh, yeah, this is good for both of us. Maybe I should be over here and we should do these things. And I think for me, that was the case with Persephone, because that was Ari's goddess, and now she's pretty essential in my own life, but you know, it took a while to get there.
What is it like to have a household full of gods and spirits that, you know, you're working with these gods, Ari's working with these other gods? I don't live in an environment like that. I'm aware of them. I have pagan friends who are, you know, like I have a friend who he's very, very Norse, kind of Norse druid hybrid kind of a guy. And he's very strict in his approach to things. And his wife is like the exact opposite. And they go off into their own worlds. They do their own things. You know, they don't really have too much of a imagery and stuff in like the shared spaces, you know, like they don't seem like their spirits are like, you know, in a great place. But then I have friends who like, you know, one guy worships Kuan Yin and has this very interesting witchcraft practice devoted to Kuan Yin. I would love to hear more about it. And then his partner is devoted to a war goddess, and they do very fucking different. Right. And so like, what is it like to fit all of that into like one roof? Like, I mean, just as like a magical being, what is that like?
I don't think that Ari and I's like deity relationships are really very much in conflict with each other. It always feels pretty natural. You know, I mean, even if Ari's not necessarily super close to Pan, she understands who Pan is because she's had experiences with Pan and knows how important Pan is to my own life. So, you know, Pan has a Laura Tempest Zachroff painting in the ritual room, just like Aphrodite. And curiously enough, they're next to each other. Like that, not to imply that they're necessarily pairs, but that's how we got them. And it just seems natural that they're together in this way.
Yeah.
Maybe that represents something about Ari and I's relationship. You know, I'm the more lustful one and she's the more loving one or something. You know, and with Persephone, you know, we have Laura Tempest Zachroff Persephone, and right next to her is Dionysus, right? And to me, Dionysus, though, is the god of life. He's also sort of this god of death. If you read some of his other mythologies and some of the other things about Dionysus, there's, you know, this other aspect to him. And yeah, they all seem really compatible. The only one that's really sort of strange is there's a certain Catholic folk saint that I am very close to who personifies death that Ari's not wild about, that we have an altar to her in my office. However, Ari like gives me presents like to give to her. She's like, here, you know, I got this for you for her. I know that, you know, you have this giant altar for her because she doesn't play well with others. Why don't you put that there? You know, so everything is really cooperative when it comes to deities in the house, which is really nice. And, you know, they have their own spaces too. Like I love Marie Laveau. I don't practice voodoo, would never claim to practice voodoo, but Marie Laveau has a place in my office. She's got like a little shrine dedicated to her with statues of her there and some candles and things. And it's just for me. It's not really for anybody else. And it's her space. She was a Catholic woman in addition to practicing voodoo. She doesn't have to share that space with anyone else. Right. So
yeah,
I think the gods can, and other beings can sort of compartmentalize themselves to some degree too.
So how do you feel about like mixing gods from different traditions? Because I would imagine like, you know, the Greek gods, the Roman gods, they all get along. It's pretty chill. But, you know, in the case of like Marie Laveau, right? So you've got a little space for her. How does that all jive? Like that's interesting to me.
Well, I certainly wouldn't call her in a Wiccan circle, right? I think that
would be
disrespectful. I don't, you know, it shows a complete lack of understanding in a way of who Marie Laveau was, because that was not what she practiced. And she'd be like, you know, what the fuck is this? What are you doing? Why am I here? Right? I should be in New Orleans.
Right, right.
People doing the things that I did. So, you know, kind of cognizant of where and when to call deities. But things like Celtic gods, Roman gods, Greek gods, even the Norse gods, they have been part of the Western magical tradition for over 2,000 years. You know, you can read grimoires from the 14th, 15th, 16th century. Periodically, gods are invoked in those. That doesn't mean they were necessarily pagans, but they knew that some of these formulas worked. Obviously, too, you have the planets being invoked, which are named after deities. Then you have groups like the Golden Dawn and some of their precursors also calling to deities. So I think that those deities are comfortable in like a Wiccan circle or whatever, right? But I wouldn't call Shiva to be there. I mean, Shiva's somebody who hangs out in Hindu temples where they worship Shiva all the time. I don't think that Shiva wants to be in a Wiccan circle because that's not Shiva's experience. And I could be wrong. I don't want to speak for the gods, but it's just in my practice, it doesn't seem right.
That so, seems like a good prohibition to have, I would say. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I love Cronos. Cronos is not a Greek god because my other two are Pan and Dionysus. But if you go and you look at things in Gaul, where Cronos was worshipped, modern day France, Gaul, he shared space with Roman deities. He shared space with Hermes, and he shared spaces with Apollo and Zeus. So I have to think that he was at least, you know, familiar with Pan and Dionysus, because he knew, you know, he knew Pan's father, Hermes, you know, he knew Dionysus's father, Zeus, right? So, you know, I think that there's a level of understanding there, you know, because in the ancient world, they were worshipped, if not necessarily side by side, at least in close proximity.
Right, right. Okay. Yeah. So a little bit of a segue, sorta-esque, because we've got something to talk about that's coming up for you, which is you do have a spell book that's coming up, and I'm very super into it. I love spell books. I think spell books are, I think every author, if you're a witchcraft author, you should have a spell book that comes out. Like that's my personal, like I look for that in the collection of an author's stuff. So I'm a big fan of spell books. I'm very excited to get my hands on this. I want to ask you, as we're talking about gods, and I want to kind of segue into spells here. How do you feel about spells? Like, you know, you pick up a Llewellyn periodical. We both, you know, obviously are published for Llewellyn, so I get to pick on them. So I'm just going to pick on Llewellyn here. You pick up a Llewellyn, let's say the Spell a Day Almanac or whatever. You go through and it says Aphrodite spell for, I don't know, a good time, right? And you flip it out, you know, the next page over, and you've got a Shiva spell for a bad time, right? And then you go through and you flip another one. So you go through and you have these like spells that are, you know, under the name of a god, but they're being written for just a mass audience, right? So let's say I don't know who Shiva is. I don't know who Aphrodite is. I'm getting this book. Like, how do you feel about that? Like, what's your thoughts on that kind of stuff? Because to me, I always look at that and I've just been like, eh. Like, I just have always instinctively just kind of been like, eh, unless I had a relationship with the spirit. I mean, I may look at the thing and, you know, break the technology apart and go, oh, okay, and I can rework this. Like, I have an invocation to Diana that I've used since I was 13 years old that is totally a ripoff of a invocation of Athena. And it was just, it's all, you know, things were reworked. I didn't know that, but it's just what I got. And that's what I've been using. And, you know, I like it. But I have a relationship with her. So if there's a spell that uses Diana for something or works with, I hate to say use, works with Diana for something, I'm cool with that. But I'm not necessarily like, I've just never been that type of a fluid type of witch. Like, how do you feel about that kind of stuff?
Wow. You know, there's two parts of me that are like fighting each other when it comes to the answer. So one of the things, like when I do classes on something like drawing down the moon or whatever, one of the things I always say is, would you just call somebody up and ask for a favor if you didn't know them? Right? Like, hey,
right, exactly. Or,
you know,
yeah.
Send somebody a random text. Hey, person I don't know, can you loan me $20?
Right, right.
You
right,
wouldn't
right.
do that.
I'm in Africa. Can you please send me Dr. you know, blah, 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 yes. $1 million? Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Yeah. So part of me looks at it that way. Like, maybe before you do this spell, maybe you should say something to them first, pour them a libation. You know, I think that working with deity and other higher powers can be like a quid pro quo thing to a degree. But then there's the second part of me that says, hey, what if this is the gateway for somebody, right? They see
absolutely
spell for Aphrodite and they don't really know Aphrodite, but maybe Aphrodite pushed them to pick up that almanac and read that particular spell and wanted it there for them for that particular day so that they would come to know her. Probably there's two things that are going to happen that could happen. One is you do the spell and you don't know the deity and they don't listen to you anyways. So nothing is gained, but nothing is lost, right? It's like when you get that email from the prince looking to transfer their money, you just delete it and go on. Maybe they do that. Or maybe the other thing happens where, you do the spell and they wanted you to do the spell and it begins some sort of relationship. So it probably doesn't hurt to do it, but unless they have an interest in you, it's probably not going to be successful. I would also, try to talk to them first. But if you didn't, the consequences are probably pretty minimal.
Yeah. Okay. I'm here with you on that. That's okay. I like the idea of like at least pour them a drink, right? Like that's my joke with everybody. Like, buy me a drink first, right? Like, come on.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. I like that. So buy them a drink and see where it goes. I think that's good advice, actually. Cause I always just kind of go, usually when I see it, I don't know. I'm a little biased, especially but I'll pour them a drink though.
Well, especially those spell a day spells. So I write for the spell a day count, like the spell.
Right.
A day
me too.
Almanac.
Right.
Yeah. And you get 150 words to do a spell. I mean, they're pretty small spells, right? I mean, if you're looking to buy a new house or something, that's not the spell book I would go for. I'd want to do something bigger and grander that would take throw more energy at my problem.
Absolutely.
Than what I can do in 142 words.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true.
Yeah. And I was going to say, I think you're absolutely right too. I think that when you write witch books, like eventually you're contractually obligated to write some sort of spell book or magic book.
Well, because it used to be that's what all magic books were just you'd get somebody's book and it was all spells. I mean, Cunningham, I think the reason why Cunningham was so successful was that there was like background, right? There was more to it than just you're finding somebody's pamphlet on lucky numbers that are used in this, weird way or whatever. Or it's like some really hard to find grimoire at the time. Right. Now we can find anything, as you were saying, but so it's all changed, but there's this, like, that's what magic books were. So when you think of a book of magic, you just think of a spell book, you think of ritual, whatever. And then our generation of authors and the one, that came before us, we get to talk more about theory. We get to talk more about practice and kind of putting those things together. And I think that's really fun. So, we get these books that come out from, unknown people who are actually probably just an algorithm, right, in a computer. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be a spell book because that's what like publishers instinctively think witches spells, so that's just that all that stuff always ends up like. So I feel like people like us who are writing about theory and we're writing about practice, I think we're really the ones that are having that discussion about what the craft is, what the state of the craft is now, right? Like I'm not trying to sound arrogant here, but when you think about, what the state of the craft was 100 years ago or 50 years ago, you're probably going to think of people like, Crowley, you're going to think of Sanders, you're going to think of people who were writing books, right? You're going to think of Buckland right now. At this point. You're going to think about people who were writing the books that were trying to discuss the theory, that were trying to bring those things out. And so I find that, we have to kind of do that for a while before we can write a spell book almost like just from a marketing standpoint. Like I know with Llewellyn, I'd gone to them with Modern Witches, the idea originally. And they were like, well, we need to know that you can actually sell books first. Like we need to know that you're actually capable of writing books first. Right. Cause they weren't looking for Crone's Book of Magic. Right. Which is this really fun book of just spells, but it's just spells. And unless you're into it, it's just this, So it was for me, I had to write the book series before I could write the spell book. And I'm okay with that. Like if that's the way, that's what they needed for me. That's what I needed for me. Actually, I didn't know it at the time, all that good stuff. But it's just so synonymous with the idea of being a witchcraft author to have that spell book. So I feel like it's the one thing, like I said, I look for in everybody's collection, right? And I don't judge anybody. I mean, because I think witchcraft is so subjective, I don't think we can really safely judge anybody's work. But I think we can definitely look at it in relationship to the discussion that's happening. And I love when authors who are part of the discussion share their witchcraft, like their actual, this is how I cast a spell, this is how I do my thing. And because that's where you get to see their UPG. That's where you get to see what tickles them, what, you know, as my mother would say, what tickles me. That's the kind of, you get to really see their personality come out, I think, more in that magic than often sometimes in those theories, you know, in the theory stuff, because we have to formulate ideas differently. We have to, you know, approach things differently when you're writing in that way. But when you get to write about spells, that is when I always tend to see the most of an author's personality come out. And that's the stuff that I like to see. So, you know, as a witchcraft book nerd, you know, of, you know, going on 20 something years now, that is the thing I look for in somebody's collection. And then when you see them like come out with a bunch of spell books, like Judica Illis has a bunch of different spell books, that's prolific, right? Like, and she didn't just write it. It's a whole
thousand spells, yeah. Right? I mean, the big insane one. Yeah.
So anyway, so you're a spellbook. So with this, what was that? So why now to do the spells? Like what actually triggered that decision going from, you know, again, yeah, you know, you do usually write about theory and you're usually writing about, you know, gods and deities and things. What triggered going into the spellcraft part of your, you know, your experience?
So it's funny when you talk about, you know, you get to really see how they practice things. So the spell book I wrote with three people in my coven, Matt Cavelli, Amanda Lynn, and my wife, Ari. And
have not met Amanda. I don't think I've met Amanda. I know I've met Matt. I think Matt is absolutely an adorable light. And like when Matt walks into a space, energy just kind of like shifts and cleanses very quickly, I've noticed. Like I've seen this at PantheaCon. I've seen it in the store that he works at, Moonstone. And I, when people talk about like natural witches, to me, how I judge, quote, I hate to say judge that, but how I determine like, oh, that person's a witch, like a natural witch or not, is if just they psychically shift things in a room. You do it, Ari does it, Matt does it. Like I know this. And I don't think I've met Amanda. I probably have. I feel like I have, but I don't, her name, her head's not popping up in my head, but I know Matt. And so I'm interested in this because I know that there are these like people who I would consider to be those naturally talented witches who can psychically shift things in a space just by walking into it. Right. Like I've seen Matt do, like I've seen a person like literally having a meltdown, crying in somebody's arm. Matt walks into the booth next to him, like just sets up. And then suddenly this woman who has been crying for like 20 minutes, just like takes a breath and then like it was so obvious like what had happened. It was just one of those trippy things. I'll never forget that. So okay, so I'm excited that he's right. So I knew, okay, this I'm excited about. Bring it on.
So when we do magic in our coven, right, I mean, I'm the kind of person who's like, okay, we're gonna build the cone of power, or we're gonna dance the witch's mill. Those are the kind of things that I do. But when we need a specific spell, what I do is I go, Ari, we need a spell, because she's really good at writing spells and I am shit usually at writing spells. I've gotten better just because.
Well, what determines that for you though? Like what do you mean she's better at it than you are?
Oh, so, you know, we're in the ritual room or we're doing something and, you know, we're that point where the coven is, we're kind of like taking requests, right? Like, you know, do you have a problem? Do you need something fixed? Is there some magic that you need? You know, we'll work on that here right now. So Ari will, and often with Matt too, which is amazing. They'll just, okay, this is what you need. And then she'll just walk around our ritual space and gather up all of these things and then have this spell written in her head. Like in 10 or like 30 seconds sometimes, maybe a minute or two, but it happens really fast. And it's just so intuitive to them. You know, for me, I would like go through a bunch of books and think about it and like, oh, you want this? And oh, I'm colorblind. Can you help me pick out this stone? Because they all look the same to me, you know. And Ari, it's like, there's a deity touching her shoulder, just sort of walking her around and picking things up and, you know, telling her to do this. They're just intuitive when it comes to magic in a way that I am not. Now, can I write what they just did and make it sound flowery and poetic? Yes. And kind of explain, you know, why some of the choices were made. Absolutely. But they're very, very good at putting together spells. So like in our coven, that's just what we do. My friend Angus, and I'm sure you've met Angus, Angus McMahon, who,
oh yes,
who writes in a couple of spots. You know, he's in our coven. He goes, I could just watch Ari do this for hours, which I think is like the highest form of compliment.
Totally.
Yeah.
Well, Ari is, I mean, she's a force of nature. Like, I just think she's just, first of all, honestly, I had the biggest crush on your wife for years. Like, I was like, I just want to like do her hair and like get drunk together and then make some dumb choices and, you know, but it'll all be okay because Jason will forgive both of us. You know, and it'll be okay. And like, I had like the biggest, and it was just in that sense of like, she's kind of fucking majestic. Like your wife is like this majestic being. Like I just adore her. And I've seen her do the like on the spot priestess thing with people. And I have so much love and respect for your family and your coven. I mean, you're good people. You know your witchcraft, you know your stuff. So how did you like, so you're in the situation where you're getting to work with your coven on a book.
Yeah.
That's fucking cool. What was that like?
Well, it happened during COVID. So it was not exactly like we wanted it to be. So, you know, we did a lot of the work last summer and fall through the, so it'd be like the summer and fall of 2020. Right. And, you know, and then I'm kind of cleaning it up, the manuscript up over the first few months of 2021. You know, and the original plan was we were going to meet every other week and we were going to talk about whatever magical discipline was the focus of the book for on that particular period. Like the book kind of looks at various things that witches use in magic and sort of why it works. You know, like if you carry a sprig of rosemary in your pocket, what does that do? How much power does that have? This book kind of endeavors to explain some of those things.
Beautiful.
So like, you know, like one night the plan is, you know, to talk about incenses and oils, things that are mostly smelly. You know, I think that was the, you know, our topic of conversation. And then we were going to talk about it and the theories of how it works. And because of four different witches writing a book, you know, I'm taking notes and sometimes the notes contradict themselves because every witch is different, right? Like we look at things differently. I remember we were writing pyrite and Matt and Amanda, like you should use pyrite in spells for like financial success and to attract money. And I'm like, if I would use pyrite if I was trying to trick somebody, because to me, pyrite is tricksy because it's not gold.
Okay. But you know what they just found out though, right? There is gold inside of pyrite.
Well, as I said, they're all smarter than I am. So, you know, they were right and I was wrong. So, but you know, like there are little things like that where we kind of contradict each other because magic is messy and it's not, you know, not everyone's
exactly
no. about everything. Yeah. So there are all these different perspectives. And then we were supposed to go to our ritual room and I was just really going to watch the three of them put spells together and take notes and then put together spells from watching them work. Tried to do this in like in a really organic way, but because of COVID, we couldn't do that because we couldn't be indoors together. You know, there a lot of this happened when lockdowns were in effect and December of 2020, like the state of California said, you know, no, you can't really have people in your house.
Right.
We're telling you not to do this. So instead of this really super collaborative thing, it became a lot of Zoom meetings and stuff, which was still effective because we had the good conversations, but the spells ended up not being as collaborative as I wanted. But I still feel like everybody's voice got in the book and it was really fun working with other people and kind of getting their perspectives. I mean, I wrote a book with Laura Tempest Sackroff once, but what we did was I wrote a chapter and she wrote a chapter and you can tell pretty much who wrote what. For the book, I took notes about what people told me and then kind of wrote everything with the exception of a couple of spells. But even then, I edited those. So it's you know, probably everyone's voice, but filtered through my style of writing. But it's really cool to work with your coven. You know, you gain insight. I like Matt and Amanda more now than I did before we started the project, which is always a good sign.
Yeah.
You know, when you work with somebody, you always kind of worry. It doesn't
always work out. Yep. Yeah. Absolutely.
But to have really good discussions about magic. And sometimes we don't really have discussions about it. You know, like, why, you know, why are you using this herb or this thing for a particular spell? Or why do you think it's associated with this particular property? You know, so we got to spend time talking about it and sort of deciding why we thought these things worked in the ways that they did. And so it was nice to discuss magic. Yeah. Ari doesn't like talking like about, you know, deities so much, but she really likes talking about magic and why different things work. So that was really fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I know the pandemic has been so difficult and, it, you know, and we just thought we were going to like start to get out of it. And Matt and I were supposed to go do a conference in Maryland that got canceled because there's going to be peak. Yep. Ticket space. And I was actually going to be teaching a workshop on basically the history of correspondences, like where they come from, why they're used, all that kind of stuff. And I was really excited about it. It would have been the first time, and God knows how it feels like. It feels like a lifetime of not being able to go and teach in person. You know, it just feels so weird. So I think anytime that we've been able to rise to the occasion and find ways to work with the people who matter to us right now, you know, in these long distance settings and things, I think that's so important. I think it's beautiful that you have a relationship with your coven that allowed for something like this to happen, like, and to drop. I think it's going to be fun to have the spell book, you know, like I'm excited about this. I'm super, super excited about this. Do you have another like spell book in mind for that's going to be just, or is this the spell book for you?
This is probably the spell book.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. It's a lot of work.
You know, I love books that mix sort of practical ideas with doing. So to write about, you know, different types of incenses and how, you know, like what works best and maybe why you should avoid this kind because of these things that are involved. You know, that part I really like. And then after that, you know, there's all these spells using incense and stuff. And so I got to combine these sort of two different things that I really, really love. And when I was kind of putting together the idea of the book, because I wanted to look at, you know, as I said, the various disciplines, whether it's candles or creative visualization, gems and crystals and stones, plants and other things maybe you find in your kitchen and going on through, you know, I was thinking about it and I was thinking about people who were really invested in some of those disciplines. Like Matt's really good with working with herbs and natural things in a way that I'm not. And Ari's really good with working with stones in a way that I'm not. And Amanda is really into oils in a way that I'm not. So thinking about how to write the spells and to how to present this information, I wanted people who were really passionate about these various magical disciplines. So when I was kind of putting the idea for the book together, I was like, I'm gonna use Matt, because at first it was just gonna be me and Matt, and then I was like, Matt's like, no, Amanda, we should bring Amanda in, and oh Jason, we have to bring Ari in. So you know, it just kind of kept growing from there. But I like it because you can't learn everything. Right. You can
absolutely right.
You can learn a lot of things, and books are great because then you can look up the stuff that you don't know or you just don't want to commit to memory. So
right. What I tell people all the time. I'm like, no, like I have reference books. And eventually, I mean, you reference stuff so many times that it sticks in your head finally, like, you know, anything else. But for the most part, I mean, I don't have that much bandwidth or space in my brain for all of this shit. So, you know, having friends who are passionate about what the topic is that I know I can turn to has been a critical, I think, step in my own spiritual development, right? Because not only just you get different viewpoints and, you know, something has more weight, you know, with somebody than somebody else does and things like that, but you also end up being able to form a more balanced
actual approach and opinion to the subject matter, right? Like it's, I think having that there is such a beautiful thing. How did this, I know we're totally going over our time and I appreciate your patience, but how do you feel like, do you feel like this was a positive thing for your coven? Like this was a good, like this made, this worked out in a good way?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it hasn't come out yet. So maybe they'll hate being authors because being an author comes with bullshit. Right.
Oh,
you know,
yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, maybe they'll end up hating my name when it's all said and done. How dare you get us involved in this crap, Jason? But, you know, I think it's good when you love somebody and you get to kind of birth something with them, which really I kind of look at books as like my babies. Right. Because there's always a journey with them and a process and discovery and creation and all these different things.
Yeah.
So I mean, but I got to learn more about Matt and Amanda while writing the book with them. I got to learn more about Ari and her practice because, you know, there are things that you don't discuss. And then I'm sitting down, I'm like, Ari, all right, you're up. We're talking about stones. You know, we go out and go to the wine bar and sit outside 6 feet away from everybody else, which was nice for privacy. And, you know, I ask her about stones, like, you know, what does tourmaline do, right? And she's like, well, it does this, Jason, you know. And, you know, she's not looking shit up. She just knows it, you know. And she's like, this is what it means for me, you know. And she's like, you could probably read some Cunningham or Nicholas Pearson. I think his books are terrific on stones. But you could read some of these other writers and maybe they're not going to agree. But this is what I think. And write that down, and I kind of got some insight into my wife, and also, you know, to look at the spells, and she got insight into me too, because some of my spells are like, you know, spells like shut your lying mouth, liar, you know, and they're kind of aggressive, right? Like put duct tape over the puppet's mouth, you know. And Ari's like, wow, there's a side to you I didn't know about, husband. And some of Matt's were like that too, you know, like, you know, I have this other side that the other two didn't. So like, I thought our book was really happy. And then, you know, I read like one of these things that you submitted.
And then suddenly the truth is revealed.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of, thank you so much, Jason, for taking the time to come back on the show. Everybody, the show notes have all of the information you could possibly need in order to find Jason, find his books, get his books in all of the different formats and all of the different ways. So you don't have to go anywhere. You can just check out the show notes. Go to modernwitch.com or Jason, what's your website?
You can visit me at panmanky.com, which is my last name with the god Pan in front of it. And I don't, you know, I just feel bad promoting another podcast on your podcast.
Please, no, please.
Yeah. This month I'm debuting Witch With Books with Meg Rosenbrier.
I love her.
Started the Witch With Me community.
I really adore her.
By the time this is out, that should be out too. Yeah.
So okay.
That's going to be really fun.
Then I will make sure that we put a link in the show notes for that. And that's awesome. And give my love to Meg. And I wish you both 1,000,000 followers. So if you are subscribed to my show, please go subscribe to their show and spread that Modern Witch love on over. That's really cool, Jason. I think that's going to be amazing.
Thank you. This has been fun. It's always a pleasure talking to you. We don't live that far apart, but we can see each other.
But we're worlds apart, right? It always feels that way. I know for years, I think I only saw you in other states.
Yeah.
And so that was the thing. But hopefully we can fix that.
But. So shall we make out in Detroit or Ohio? You know, that was where we were.
Honestly, Jason, anytime, anywhere.
Absolutely.
All right. Give my love to all of the peeps and I will talk to you soon, my friend.
All right. Thank you. Love you, Devin.
Love you too, sir. Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is the end, beautiful friend.
All right, and that does it for this episode of the Modern Witch Podcast. I'm your host, Devin Hunter. You were just listening to a really fun interview with Jason Mankey. And, you know, it's usually one of these things I'd split up and do like a macro, micro version of the show and give the Patreon people, you know, a little bit extra. But I got to be honest, I didn't know where to cut it. And he and I just kind of start talking because he's a good guy. So I hope that you enjoyed the show. Once again, the book is called The Witch's Book of Spellcraft,
practical guide to connecting with the magic of candles, crystals, plants, and herbs. Once again, by Jason Menke, Matt Cavalli, Amanda Lynn, and Ari Menke. And again, you've been listening to the Modern Witch Podcast. Go to modernwitch.com for more Modern Witchy things. Don't forget to check out the Patreon. Don't forget to like and subscribe on whatever platform that you are liking and subscribing. All of that really does help me get the show out there and let people know it's worth it. I'll see you next week.
There are forces at work here, dark, incomprehensible forces.